to the K through Z's. I don't get to be with you maybe for a while. Last Sunday, Philip announced at the beginning of his lesson that he had done a search to determine whether it had been a lesson on the mustard seed in recent times or not. And he discovered that there had never been a lesson on mustard seeds before. Well, I want to begin my lesson by announcing that I have preached this lesson before. And it's a rerun. And I suspect that maybe in the past few weeks, we have, some of us who have TV, have watched a few reruns on TV and maybe not even been too upset about it, even if we've seen it before. But I think this lesson has come back over the years. To me, it's one very useful and necessary. I hope you'll find it that way as well. Now, I don't mean to say that I just preached it an hour or so ago. That's true, too. But also maybe about 13 years ago. So at some point through the magic of the Internet, there will be two lessons with the same title if you go and search our list of sermons. I want to imagine a situation in which maybe you move to a new city or in some way or another decide that you'd like to visit a new congregation and maybe become a member there. And so you go up and the building's nicely groomed. It has the proper sign out front. The meeting times are not too strange. And you go in and the service is conducted in a way that it doesn't surprise you. These are the things that you expected to go on. And the scriptures are read in the same way. And so it looks fairly ordinary. But after a while, you begin to notice some things that are disappointing. For one thing, you begin to learn that there are problems in the church for which the Lord has given us tools to address that go unaddressed just because of a lack of faith. Perhaps there is immorality in which there might be some discipline that's required. Perhaps there's an outreach to the lost, and the church has sufficient money in the treasury to support men to preach, to have various outreaches events, but they just don't have the faith to do that. And maybe within some of the families, there are family problems that really need to be addressed. And you know God has given us the tools to do that. And yet sometimes because of a lack of faith, because we're afraid of what terrible things might happen or how people might react, we just don't act. And so we're not able to do the work God has done. And I'm saying in first person, but I imagine this church that you're going to is struggling with that very same thing. And although they read the scripture, and sometimes even challenging scriptures. Scriptures like turning the other cheek and loving your enemies and forgiving those for many times, 70 times 7, even those who have hurt me badly. And a lot of other things about the rich young ruler and difficult passages like that. It's pretty clear that these passages are not sinking in and they're not changing anyone's behavior. And worse than that, it just appears that there's really kind of a reluctance to even to look into the thing, to ask questions. What does this verse mean? How might I change to be more compatible with what Jesus has told us to do? And so it seems like their minds are closed to the truth, especially anything that would represent a change or make me cause me to examine my own behavior. But in addition to that, after a little while, it's pretty clear that there's competition among the group. I don't know why it is, but some tasks that get kind of the publicity, that turn up in front of people, that somehow get some praise, maybe people think you got to be more qualified to do them. People really want to have those jobs, right? They want to be in a position of authority, or they want to be in a position of visibility or respect or praise or something. And so there's pretty clearly some argument going on about who should be the leaders, and people get upset when they're not picked to do certain things and so on. You see that in the group itself. Not only that, especially as an outsider, you notice that there's a party spirit. Some churches, you know, are all made up of like relatives of the same family. Or it might just be that the church has all these original members and these newcomers that come from other states or don't go to the right college, they're kind of excluded and they're not welcome in the group. And even those who have skills and talents that could be put to use are rejected just because they're not part of the original family or the original group that started the church or in some way not the same type of people. And finally, there is no outreach in this church at all to the outside. There's a lack of love for the lost. And it's pretty clear that there's not an outreach to try to save people who are even in the nearby area. And it's not too hidden that it's just racism. There's just some feeling that these people that we might reach out to are not as worthy as others to reach to with the gospel. And you can even tell by some of the language and some of the proposals that there's an attempt to exclude people really kind of based on their economic background or maybe the color of their skin. Has it ever happened to you, any of these things? Is it possible that a church that looks kind of okay on the outside and that does the right things on the surface would have these kinds of problems? There are five of them here, you probably noticed, somewhat interrelated. But is it possible we might have that to face that sometime in our life? I want you to turn to Luke chapter 9. We'll look at that chapter as the primary text for our lesson this morning. And I want to talk about imperfection, not in the world, not in our society, but in our brethren. Maybe someone in the same church, maybe someone on the same pew as the pew you're sitting on this morning. And let's just see if we can learn some lessons from these incidents that occur in Luke chapter 9. I'm going to take a running start and talk about the background of Luke 9 because I think that will help us see these incidents in kind of a larger context of the trajectory of Jesus' ministry. You understand that, just going back to chapter 8, but I would just say that Jesus' ministry, if you take John's chronology and the four, what we think are the four Passover feasts, that makes 3 years, right? Four feasts, 3 years. And this place in Luke is about at the time of the third Passover. And that was at the time of the feeding of the 5,000. So we're 2 out of the 3 years in. There's still a year to go. And during that first year, we remember Jesus' popularity went from kind of unknown to kind of impressive to just throngs of people. And you'll see that in these incidents in chapter 8 and 9 that lead up to the text we want to look at this morning. There were two great miracles there. In chapter 8. One was the stilling of the tempest, probably Jesus' most impressive demonstration of his power over the natural world. So that the apostles asked, who is this that even the winds and the waves obey him? And he landed on the shore and this fella comes running out with legion demons, right? And he casts them out. And this guy answers their question but says, what have I to do to you, Son of God Most High? He answers that question the disciples asked. But then Jesus cast them out into the swine, you remember. Perhaps Jesus' most impressive demonstration of power over the supernatural world, back to back. And then there's that double miracle where on his way to raise Jairus' daughter, the woman with the issue of blood touches him, right? And you notice in that miracle this reference to people pressing in on him so that when he says, who touched me? They say, what do you mean who touched you? There are people, and you get the sense of throngs of crowds of people that are following because of his miracles and other things that he's done. At the beginning of chapter 9, verse 1, the 12 that he had chosen are sent out preaching. And he gives them power over demons and the ability to heal. And you look down in verse 6 of chapter 9, and sure enough, they are successful. He didn't just give them the power, they were actually able to do it. And so now the word is spreading not just through Jesus himself, but through others on his behalf, even without his influence. And then, speaking of crowds of people, they gather back together. They come back to report what had happened. And there are 5,000 people who need to be fed. And you've been following Bill's lessons on the miracles. This one's the one that's recorded in all four accounts of Jesus' life. And he feeds 5,000 men plus women and children. And, of course, a lot of popularity. Then the crowds begin to follow him to a great extent. Perhaps as a result of all of that, Jesus asks, who do men say that I am? And they tell him, and then who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus is thrilled with that. You can just tell he is happy. And he says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. Peter apparently had come to that conclusion through the revelation, maybe through Jesus' teaching and the miracles themselves, but not even through flesh and blood. And then to cap it off, the transfiguration. They climb up the mountain and the three disciples, Peter, James and John with Jesus, go and the windows of heaven are open and the nature, the supernatural splendor of Jesus shines through, whiter than any garment could ever be made white. so that later Peter would say, we did not follow cunningly devised fable. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. And John would say, and we beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Had it just be striking to them. And so you see in this story, then, this trajectory of crowds, of miracles, powerful miracles, of great confessions made. This is surely a peak in Jesus' ministry. But we get to chapter 9, verse 37. And I wish you'd read these incidents with me. I might just note that in your Bible, you may notice that beginning with verse 37 in Luke, if you have paragraph markers, which, by the way, I don't think there were paragraph markers in the Greek, but it's pretty clear that the people who print it know that these are separate stories, but they get real short. Do you notice that? The paragraph headings are close together, or something. You may just have a bolded verse number. But these are just one story after another. We're going to look at five, but I'll note that the same theme carries on to the next story after that. It just doesn't have to do with the 12 apostles particularly. Let's begin in verse 37. Now, it happened on the next day. And by the way, I'll mention this too, that Luke, in his account, not only puts these events together, but he seems to even hook them in time while they were marveling. And so there's even this kind of hook that these seem to be one after another, at least until verse 51. Now, it happened on the next day when they had come down from the mountain. Now, I see some literary picture in that. They're coming down from the mountain. And they had met, if you remember, Moses and Elijah. And I can't help but think about Moses coming down from Mount Sinai. Do you remember what happened? He might have been real thrilled that he had the law written on stone that God had given him. But he heard this tumult. He heard something going on. It was not good news. And that's kind of what Jesus and his three apostles that were with him find. They'd come down from the mountain. A great multitude met him. We learn from other accounts. Mark, by the way, also records these events in Mark chapter 9, coincidentally, and Matthew 17. And we'll refer briefly to those for some additional details. But it appears that there was an argument going on. The scribes had them all tied up, perhaps. Maybe they had gotten nervous and they couldn't do this exorcism as a result. But anyway, suddenly a man from the multitude cried out, "Teacher, I implore you, look on my son, for he's my only child. Behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth, and it departs from him with great difficulty, bruising him. And I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." Now, why couldn't they do that? There's a discussion in the other accounts about how maybe this is. But really, if you look at Matthew 17, Jesus just says, they ask him, why couldn't we cast it out? He says, because you don't have any faith. That's what he says. There's more to be said, perhaps, but he starts by saying you have little faith. And here in Luke, look at what he says. Jesus answered and said, "O faithless and perverse generation." Does that sound like some level of exasperation with them? That they should have been able to do it? How long shall I be with you? Bring your son here. As he was still coming, the demon threw him down and convulsed him. Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the child, and gave him back to his father. Look back to chapter 9, verse 1. Same chapter. Had he given them power over the demons? Yes. Had they been successful? Yes. What's the story? Lack of faith. Lack of faith to do the work that they had to do. They failed to cast out a demon. What is that? A lack of faith to do God's work. I hope your memory is good enough to remember the five things we talked about before in that kind of that horror story about that church you went to. But still, they had a lack of faith to do his work. Well, let's read on. Verse 43. And they were all amazed with the majesty of God. But while, there's the time hook, while everyone marveled at all the things which Jesus did, he said to his disciples, "Let these words sink down into your ears. For the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men." But they did not understand this saying, and it was hidden from them, so that they did not perceive it. They were afraid to ask him about this saying. Do those words look confusing to you? I mean, is there anything about a seven-headed dragon and crowns and stuff like that in what Jesus said? It says they were held from understanding it, but do you think that's a miraculous thing with the Spirit kind of, you know, covered? No, I think something else is going on. Because he said, let these words sink down. What was his intent? Is for them to understand it. I think that's right. And could it have been any clearer? Let these words, the Son of Man is about to be delivered to the hands of men. Well, it had been clearer. Look back to verse 22. He had already said it in even more detail in this same context. But they didn't understand. And there's a hint about why, and that is they were afraid to ask. Is there anything in your life that, well, I don't know, sometimes people don't go to the doctor because they don't want to find out what the doctor might say. Does that ever happen sometimes? You don't want to look into something because you may be afraid of the bad news that would come. Is it possible that sometimes there's difficult texts, as we mentioned before in the Bible, difficult in terms of practice, not because they're hard to understand, they're just hard to do. And it means that I've been wrong for a long time, or people that I love have been wrong for a long time, or I have to do something that seems like it's going to turn out to be pretty bad. But because of the past, my preconceptions, my own ideas about what ought to be, I just can't accept it. And I certainly don't spend more time studying it, do I? I'm afraid to ask, to look into it even more. You think that's possibly what's going on? Think of all the great things Jesus had done in this past couple of chapters. The idea that he's going to be captured by his enemies. And then if you go back to verse 22 and killed and all of that, that just doesn't fit. And you know how that is. Something you believe so firmly, say in the superiority of the Messiah Christ in his earthly kingdom. Something that comes along, it may be clearly stated, but it just doesn't fit with what I already think. My preconceived ideas. And that's what kept them from understanding it. And so what has happened then is they didn't understand clear teaching and because their minds were closed to the truth. Well, let's read on verse 46. Then, from the text, then a dispute arose among them as to which of them would be the greatest. And Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, took a little child and set him by him. And he said to them, whoever receives this little child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you will be great. There's a little more detail in Mark's account in verse 34. And that is that they were walking perhaps out of earshot with Jesus and they were having this discussion. And so it makes sense that in verse 47, Jesus perceiving the thoughts of their hearts, he may not have actually heard the words they were saying, but he knew what was going on. And later, according to Mark, he asked them, what were you talking about on the way? That was their answer. They didn't answer. They knew they'd been they messed up. And they were just kind of thinking speculatively about how will Jesus organize his kingdom. I wonder which of... No, this was an argument. Do you see that? They were disputing. They were having some kind of discussion. And I'm sure they had arguments for their own case, right? Peter, James, and John could argue, well, we just went up on the mountain. Oh, sorry. He told us not to tell you. I can't tell you, but if I could tell you, you'd be real impressed with what we saw. Right? Philip could say, well, you know, I saw him first. One for me, you guys wouldn't even been apostles at all. Right? Matthew could say, well, you know, I'm kind of familiar with governmental operations, being a former tax collector, you know. Jews could say, well, I'm trusted with the purse, with the treasury. They all could perhaps come up with some type of an argument. But do you see how petty those are? I think they knew how petty their arguments were, and so they didn't even answer Jesus, according to Mark, when he said, what were you talking about along the way? But there was a party spirit, surely a great disappointment to Jesus. And it's interesting that he takes the, I think there's something to be said for the lesson here. In Matthew 18, Jesus takes a child and says, unless you become as a little child, you can't enter the kingdom. That's not what happens here. He says, here, you have to receive a child in my name. What's that about? What's that about? Well, think about it. Which is more impressive? Being a great preacher, a demon caster outer, or being a babysitter? Right? Even in our situation here, there are some things that are perceived to take a lot more skill and talent. Right? They're a lot more important. They wield more authority. They have more influence. They're more highly selective to get that job. Jesus said, how about babysitting? How about taking care of kids in my name? And that's greatness. That's what greatness is. You see what he's saying? You're aspiring to things that really are not great things in the kingdom. He rebukes them with that story and that illustration. So there is competition and pride among this group of people. Well, let's read on. Are you enjoying this? Do you see this? As kind of, these are fun stories. These are great illustrations of faith, or really the lack of faith. 49. Now, John answered, see, connection there, and said, Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow with us. But Jesus said, can you imagine the body language? One after another. And Jesus, you know, how many of these do you have to, how long shall I be with you, is what he said earlier, right? Oh, John. And maybe it's in the context of this leadership thing. Hey, you know what? We saw somebody out there, not authorized. He was casting out demons in your name, and we stopped him. We took care of that for you. I think John was proud of that. I think he thought he was defending Jesus' honor, perhaps, or something. I don't know what he thought he was doing, because he followed not with it, but it wasn't the right thing to do. Jesus said, do not forbid him, for he who is not against us is for us. Was this a fake miracle worker, a fake demon exorcist? No, apparently not. Was he doing it in some pagan name? No, apparently in Jesus' name. But for some reason, John thought that wasn't appropriate. Why did he think that? Because he wasn't with us. He wasn't part of the original group here, right? And maybe he was getting credit. And by the way, had they just had a notable failure in casting out demons themselves? Interesting, right? And in the next chapter, chapter 10, verse 1, Jesus appoints 70 others and gave them power over demons. You see that? I wonder how they reacted to that. So you can see in this group of people, not only competition among themselves, but a kind of exclusive spirit, critical of outsiders, even those who were doing good works and could have been of use to them. Okay, one more. Verse 51. It came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that he had steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and then sent messengers before his face. And as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive him because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem. When his disciples, James and John, sons of thunder, Mark 3, when they saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did? But he turned and rebuked them. And he said, you do not know what manner of spirit you're of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they just went to another village. This is not a great recommendation for these apostles. They wanted to bring down fire. Remember, we mentioned that coming down from the mountain reminded us of Moses, who was up on that Mount of Transfiguration. This reminds us of Elijah, who did bring down fire on the prophets of Baal. And maybe that's what they had in mind. And after all, these are Samaritans who are the remnants of the northern kingdom where Elijah did his work, you remember. And do you understand that the Samaritans and the Jews did not like each other? And the Jews saw the Samaritans as an inferior race of people. Let's just be clear about that, right? They worshipped in the wrong place. They were just inferior, and they didn't have anything to do with them. In fact, the fact that Jesus was going through Samaria was a little unusual. It might have suggested he was in a hurry or something, but normally they wouldn't even go through the territory of Samaria. But in this case, they did, and they were rejected. And so the apostles decided, you know, I just think they need fire to come down. And by the way, when Jesus says, I didn't come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. Who is he talking about saving in this particular context? Well, it was Samaritans. It seemed like it would have to be that. I'm not going to destroy people. I'm going to save them, including Samaritans, right? And we see that work out later in the story of the gospel. So what's happening here? I think, maybe it's the Jerusalem-Gerizim conflict, but I think it's just racism. I think they just didn't care for the Samaritans, and they didn't care for the Jews either. And so let's just destroy them. Let's bring down fire. You know, in the account, I think it's in Matthew 17, where Jesus said you couldn't cast out the demon. He said, but, you know, if you had the faith of a grain of mustard seed, you remember Philip's lesson last week? That's the context. He said, you could take to this mountain, you know, come down and, be cast into the sea. And I guess they thought, well, if we can move mountains into the sea, we surely could bring down fire from heaven and take care of these Samaritans, right? Maybe they were thinking that's what would work there. But what you see there is a lack of love, a prejudice, and even a racism in these apostles. What do you learn from this, these five incidents? And don't you think that Luke now has jammed these all together to send us a message? It seems like in the book of Luke, in the gospel accounts of Luke, it's mostly chronological, but it seems like a few things are put right together to tell us something, that we should see some thematic messages that are as a result of that. I'll make the initial application, and I hope it struck you, and that is that we should expect imperfections among the best disciples. Were these Jesus' enemies? Were these the scribes and Pharisees? Were these the Roman soldiers? Were these followers of Jesus who left him because they just talked too many hard things and then they just went wild and did all these terrible things? Is that who these were? Was it just the ordinary everyday disciples? No, it wasn't even that. It was the apostles. I'll remind you that they had just been out preaching in chapter 9, in verse 1. They were preachers even, you might say. Who else should we expect better things from than this group? And yet, Luke records these five incidents back to back. Surely a message to us that we might expect some imperfections among the Christians around us. Now, I hope we learned lessons as I went through those stories about things we ought not to do. That's not the point of my sermon this morning. I hope we're not prejudiced, and I hope we don't have a lack of faith to do God's will, and I hope our minds are open to difficult truth, and I hope we don't have a party spirit, and I hope we don't have some type of aspiration and competitive spirit to have the best position. I hope we're over that, but I suspect we're not. My message, though, is, will you be surprised when someone in this church exhibits some of these characteristics? Will you be surprised at that? Will you be surprised if someone on the same pew that you're on right now? Well, I guess we're spread out. That'd be your own family member, wouldn't it? It shouldn't say that. But someone that you know quite well in the church here would exhibit some of these same flaws. And so what I want to learn from is not how we can be better, though we surely should use that lesson. But I'd like to learn from how Jesus handled that. And it is true that Jesus taught lessons that we all should take to heart personally. But I think it's also true that the way Jesus handled situations is meant for our learning as well. 1 Peter 2 says that he left us an example that we should afterward follow in his footsteps. I think that's in the context of suffering and interacting with a world that is not a believer and doesn't understand what we do. But more particularly, I'm thinking about the washing of the disciples' feet in John chapter 13. And it's clear, mention this again, but they had just had another little go around about who was greatest, unfortunately. And Jesus, perhaps in response to that, got out and washed all their feet, including Judas. And when he was done, he said, why did I do this? Dirty feet. No, I want to give you an example that you should do as I have done to you. So the way Jesus handled the difficulties among his disciples is an example to us, as well as the actual teaching he did himself. So what did he do? What did Jesus do? Well, I'm going to start with point zero, okay? And that will allow me to have a three-point sermon. But zero is not exactly in this particular group of stories, but it's clear from all the accounts that Jesus had a rich and long and deep and close and loving relationship with these men. And I think if you have that, you can do a lot of hard things. And you can deal with a lot of flaws. And you can you can do things that are difficult because you have that relationship. He had gone and sought these disciples in their homes, at their occupations. He'd gone fishing with them. He'd helped them fish. He knew their situations in life. He found Matthew at the tax collector booth. He knew all of that. He knew their personalities. And as a result of those, and they camped out together, right? For 2 years, I guess that's the way they got around and how they slept. He had defended them as they gathered the grain from the grain fields. They had been persecuted together. They had shared experiences that gave him a basis, a foundation, a trusting, loving foundation to do the things that were hard, which will come up in points 1, 2, and 3. How do we do with that? And it may be that the brethren we suspect is having the most imperfections, and I think we judge others that way. Those are the ones we probably should be building the closest relationship with as a foundation for how we can help them. Point number one is a way, it's a way as a negative point, but it's something that we need to probably say out loud, and that is he didn't cast them off or reject these disciples as useless or failures. For one thing, he'd invested 2 years in them already. But are we sometimes tempted when we see someone and we learn that they have a situation in their life, and you say, well, I don't see how they could be a Christian if that's going on. Or they make some kind of mistake, and we say, well, that proves their true character, right, in some way or another. Or they make a comment, and I'm thinking, boy, that sure had racial overtones. I'm writing that person off. They clearly have prejudice here. And so we say, that's the end of it. I'm not going any further. Jesus didn't do that. Oh, he rebuked them. It probably was not fun. I think of all the time, how would you like to spend almost all day, every day with someone who can look right into your heart and who has no reservations about telling you what you need to hear, despite how you might try to change the subject or ask questions that are irrelevant? How would you like that? But it was built on trust, and he didn't cast them off as useless or as failures. And I think we're tempted to do that. I can't worship with that person in the room, right? I got to go to another church. And we have a culture in which if you're offended in some little way, it's so easy just to go down the street to another group, as opposed to addressing these flaws. And these are serious, you have to admit, in the brethren around us, as Jesus did. I have to think about what Jesus prayed as he was right near the end of his life in John chapter 17. It's almost as if he had a mission, for sure. We'll talk about that in later point. But part of his responsibility was God had given him these men as a responsibility. He says, while I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name. Those whom you gave me, I have kept. And none of them is lost except the son of perdition, that the scripture might be fulfilled. Do you have a sense that God has given you some of the brethren around in this room as a responsibility to keep and protect? As a responsibility to keep and protect. But that's the way Jesus felt about it, and so he didn't cast them off. Well, point one is a negative point of what he didn't do. Point two, I guess, and we'll keep the numbers right, is that he did actively address the problem. Did you notice that? I probably struggle more with following Jesus' example in number two than in number one. It's a lot of trouble to go to another church, right? Or maybe ignore somebody. Cut off fellowship with them. But it's easier just to ignore it. Ignore the problem. Oh, I don't really mean ignore it. I'll go home and talk to my family about how terrible they are. I'll talk to, you know, other Christians about them. But really, I'm not going to address the problem directly, right? Jesus addressed the problem directly in a couple of ways. One is he rebuked them. I mean, look at this. It's a pretty strong language. Verse 50, do not forbid him, for he who's not against us is on our side. Verse 55, he turned and rebuked him. I get the sense of kind of right away, almost this get thee behind me, Satan reaction, really. And that is, this isn't right. You shouldn't say that. That's not the way we act. That's not the purpose of my mission, you know, whatever. And then associated with that, too, he taught them. I mean, look at the kind of teaching that's in here. First of all, in verse 44, trying to prepare them for his death, his persecution and death. In verse 48, a lesson about receiving children. In verse 50, about those who are not against us or for us. In verse 55, I came to save people, not to destroy them. He's teaching, and he had access to teaching as well. And I think that's an example, too, is that we teach. And we say things to people that they need to hear. Despite the fact that it didn't change them. Is this the last time they argued over who was the greatest? Is this the last time he said something and they couldn't quite understand it? They were arguing about who was the greatest in Luke 22, if you want to look and see, right after he instituted the Lord's Supper. And right before he said to Peter, "You're about to betray me three times." Right? And later in the book of Luke, after his death, after his resurrection, he says, "Oh, foolish and slow of heart to understand all that the prophets have said." It was still difficult for them to do. Was this the last time they showed evidence of prejudice towards Samaritans or Gentiles? It took Peter three visions years later to go speak to the Gentiles. And even after that, the incident in Antioch, recorded in Galatians, he still hadn't quite got it through his head to act the right way. When those brethren came down from Judea and he separated himself from the Gentiles. Remember all that? Did that discourage Jesus? The fact that they didn't change right away? That's my thinking. If I finally, get up the courage to notice something and say something to somebody and, I think, I have to put this in. That took care of that. They'll be different tomorrow as a result of that. Not likely. Not likely. And I know that because I'm not. The way I look at others. Yes, he taught them, even though the likelihood that they changed instantly was probably zero. Probably zero. And what enormous patience he had as the Son of God with this frail human race. As the Son of God. Speaking of that, you may be thinking, as the Son of God, he had some advantages that I don't have. You notice, you ever thought about that? I think that comes up in my thinking quite a bit. I mean, for one thing, he can look into their hearts. It says right here when he says, Jesus, verse 47, perceiving the thought of their heart. Remember that? I think John 2 mentions that Jesus knew, is it 2 or 4, mentioned he knows what's in the heart of all men, right? It was after that discussion with Nicodemus. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great if we had like a heart-o-meter, right? And it's a kind of a lens and we hold it up in front of people. And when they do something or say something, I pull that up and I say, "Oh, well, they finally revealed what's really in their heart. They are rotten to the core." And I know that because I have this heart-o-meter and I can see men's hearts. And that's finally just kind of put the nail in the coffin for what I think of them and their spiritual maturity. On the other hand, I put my heart-o-meter on somebody else and I say, "Well, that was just a mistake of the head and not the heart." Right. He's really a good guy. He's had a bad day. He's kind of tired. A lot of stress. A lot of things going on. The scribes are arguing with him. So he was under great pressure. And that's what went wrong. Remember, as in that heart-o-meter. We don't have a heart-o-meter. Jesus did. That's a frightening thing to think about. Of course, he sees our hearts every day, but we don't have that. So how am I supposed to deal with the fact that Jesus could see their hearts? Well, I think Jesus answers that in particular in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, "Judge not that you be not judged." Now, I know that passage frightens us because it's used by immoral people to say you shouldn't say I'm immoral or something like that. But skip over that for a second. Let's look at what it says. "For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you." I'd like to say that I think that the logic can be turned to say, if I'm going to judge somebody, their motive, maybe I ought to judge them the way I wish I would be judged. You ever slip up and say something you shouldn't have said, or you use the word, "I hope you shouldn't have said that"? How do you want to be judged in that moment? "Oh, he's a good guy. He just slipped up. But he had a bad day or something. Give me a break, okay? Give me a second chance." And even if I do something that I know is bad, I did intentionally and all of that, I don't want somebody to say, "Well, that's the last thing he'll ever do that's, good." And even if he does something good, he did it with a bad motive. You know what I mean? Just use that heart-o-meter thing imagine the worst possible things. I think Jesus is calling on us as we see these imperfections in others to say, "Well, they're just growing. They're having some imperfection, and I would project on them the best possible motive I could do it." And I know that's hard. But think about how we wish to be judged in our flaws. I think that's what Jesus is saying. Yeah, we don't know the facts, so let's just write the best one we can. We don't know the motives. And a similar advantage he had is also indicated here. You notice he said, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and this is I'm going to be delivered in the hands of men. If you read the earlier account in verse 22, where he said the same thing, a lot of details. Where, who, how, what's going to happen? Jesus knew the future. Wouldn't that be wonderful to actually know the future? How's this going to turn out? Jesus could say to Peter, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat. But I pray for you that your faith not fail. And when you have returned, strengthen your brethren. Wouldn't that be great? Just, I know what's going to happen. Yeah, this is temporary. You'll be back a year from now. Yeah, everything will be back. And you'll be in a position to strengthen your brethren. I don't know that. Jesus knew that James and John, the sons of thunder, John in particular, would become the disciple of love, the apostle of love. And he would be the very one to go to Samaria carrying the gifts in Acts chapter 8, once the gospel had been spread to those people. But I don't know that future. Jesus does. He knows what will happen. And I think the answer to that is maybe the same as the answer to this thing about motives, knowing motives. If I don't know the future, why don't I just write the best one I can think of? I would love to be able to say, when you're over this, when you conquer this, when you grow just a little bit, here's how useful you're going to be. And work with that, and maybe working with it, I can make it come true because of the way I treat others and the growth that I can perhaps enable with my teaching and my relationship. Paul, writing to a church that had a lot of problems, didn't they? 1 Corinthians. Including a party spirit and other things, he says, in fact, in the context here, it's the who has the best gifts and so on. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. That's the future we should write in the absence of a future-o-meter to go with our heart-o-meter. I want to say the last point here is point number three, and I would like us to look briefly again at verse 51. There seems like there's a break in the logic here in a way, because he says, now it came to pass when the time had come for him to be received up that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. If you study the book of Luke, you understand that that begins, this is the first instance, but it begins a series of similar statements. You can look over, I believe it'd be chapter 13. This isn't the very next one, but it's pretty illustrative. 13:33. Nevertheless, I must journey today, tomorrow, and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish outside Jerusalem. And even in this text, in verse 57, as they journeyed on the road, what you see in the book, and there's a lot of other references like that, is there begins to be a drumbeat of references to going to Jerusalem. What was that about? Was it just that long of a trip that it was going to take another year to get there? Because it's, you know, this is like the third Passover and going to the fourth when Jesus dies. And we know he didn't go directly there. We know from John's account that he was there for the tabernacle feast in the fall, for dedication in the winter, back another time to take care of Lazarus, to raise Lazarus, and then retired again. So it wasn't like it was a one-way trip and he slowly made his way to Jerusalem. What's this verse saying to us? Is he had a mission, and it was to get to Jerusalem. And those visits were just all part of the story that would begin to raise the opposition and lay the groundwork for that great sacrifice that would come at the end. It's not possible that a prophet should perish outside Jerusalem. He knew that was his mission. What it is saying about Jesus is, in the middle of these imperfections, Jesus says, it's time. And I'm starting now to work the plan that brings me to Jerusalem. And maybe that explains why in the fourth year the popularity dropped, the opposition rose, and it led to all the events which, totally within his control, brought about his death as a sacrifice for sin. How does that apply to us? I think in some ways, and I have trouble making this point without discounting the other, and I don't mean to do that at all. And that is, we should be people who have a private relationship with Jesus and with our Creator. And whatever happens to us, however disappointed I am, however difficult in dealing with the affairs of this world, and that includes imperfect brethren, I'm not deterred from that mission. In fact, in some ways, it gives me the strength to deal with these other things because they're not the most important thing. My identity is not caught up in whether they like me or not, or whether I've said the right thing or whatever. I have a mission. I have my face set, steadfastly set for the New Jerusalem. That's where I'm going. And if along the way I have to do difficult things or endure difficult people or be disappointed in things that are on this earth, it doesn't affect me in my mission. And you see that while Jesus appointed 70 others in the next chapter, he's still doing his work, but you know what's happening. Inexorably, he is marching with this rhythm toward his mission that he had to accomplish in Jerusalem. I think that's what this verse is saying, and that he steadfastly set his face, and then that kind of gives us purpose and meaning as he goes ahead. I think for us, these difficult things about not rejecting our brethren, building strong relationships to begin with, addressing problems, rebuking and teaching as needed, those are all in some ways empowered by our relationship with God, it seems to me. So I'm not discounting that. I'm just saying in some ways our life is centered around something way bigger and permanent and more significant than dealing with the imperfections in the brethren around us, even though God gave them to us to keep them as they had given them to Jesus. Does this help? I don't know if you are wrestling with this, but I think both of these concepts are found in the book of Galatians chapter 6, where the first couple of verses describe our responsibility to others. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, and is it possible that Christians would be overtaken in any trespass, in some trespasses? Who are those who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. You can see two or three points that are in there. First is those who have a spiritual nature. They are concerned about spiritual things. And perhaps a maturity so that you're not tempted as well. That's part of it. But also a gentle spirit and an active responsibility to go and restore such a one in some way. So those are our responsibility to others. But notice right away in verse 3, if anyone thinks himself to be something when he's nothing, he deceives himself. Let each one examine his own work. There's something private, personal, individual about our relationship with God. And then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another, for each one shall bear his own load. You see how those fit together? I know this is a kind of a difficult point. We're not ignoring others. That's part of our mission. On the other hand, the strength we have is because we have a personal relationship with the Creator. If you need to establish this morning a personal relationship with the Creator, I'm about to offer an invitation. We can take care of that. If you need to be baptized for the forgiveness of sins, recreating the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus as he has commanded us to do, we can take care of that this morning. Or something that might be needed in a public way, that's a possibility. Or something in a private way, a correction we could make that's just between us and God. We'd encourage you to do that, whatever's needed, as we stand and sing. Surrender all to him.